Hey, true crime fans. Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. With Amazon Music, you have access to the largest catalog of ad-free top podcasts included with your Prime membership. After all, ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. To start listening, download the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/adfreetruecrime. That's amazon.com/adfreetruecrime to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Your Honor, we the jury find the defendant Sweet Tango Apples guilty on all counts of being the crispiest, sweetest, zestiest, most delicious tasting apple you can buy.
Order! Order in this courtroom! Bailiff, come back here. Where are you going?
I'm going with them. I want some Sweet Tango Apples too.
You love a great mystery, but not in the produce aisle. Be sure to reach for Sweet Tango, the most delicious tasting apple money can buy. Investigate where you can get yours at sweettango.com.
Since the days of Shoeless Joe Jackson, the infamous Black Sox scandal, Pete Rose betting on baseball, and O.J. Simpson being tried for murder, we've often been disappointed by the behavior of sports figures we believed were heroes. In truth, though, professional athletes getting in trouble with the law goes back to the beginning of professional sports, and it wasn't just throwing games and betting on baseball. Like OJ, violent crimes were more common than team owners would have liked. During the latter part of the 19th century alone, there were four Major League Baseball players charged with murder. Two of them, Edgar McNabb and Marty Bergen, killed themselves before they could be brought to trial, and Charlie Sweeney did a stint behind bars at San Quentin. But on November 29, 1895, the very first professional athlete in American history to receive a death sentence was executed for the murders of his daughter and sister-in-law, a bloody act that had shocked the Illinois town where he lived. The murders and the hanging that followed 2 months later left a black mark on the city's history. And they also left two separate hauntings behind. Welcome to American Hauntings, the podcast dedicated to the history, hauntings, legends, lore, and the dark side of American history. And welcome to Season 8, Home, which is written and performed by Troy Taylor, that's me, and produced and co-hosted by Cody Back. This season, we're on a cross-country trip in search of America's murder houses, relics of time and crime gone by. We're going behind the locked doors of both famous and little-known places where murder and violence have left lingering ghosts behind. In this episode, we'll be exploring the rise and fall of a sports hero over the 19th century, a man who'd been beloved by thousands until his life took a terrible turn that led to a double murder and a tragic haunting left behind. This is episode 19 for this season, The Rise and Fall of Pacer Smith. Charles N. Smith was born in Pendleton, Indiana on August 4th, 1853. He was the fourth of 10 children of John and Rebecca Smith. John was a shoemaker who joined the Union Army shortly after the start of the Civil War. In late 1864, he was thrown from his horse and reportedly spent 6 months in a hospital. He never completely recovered from the injury, and a newspaper story would later refer to him as, quote, practically a cripple. Family members described his son Charles as a very bright boy with a penchant for sports, although he didn't play professional ball until he was 23. The game of baseball was just beginning to be popular during his early manhood, and he naturally drifted into that profession. He'd earned a good reputation as a pitcher and was offered and accepted a position with the Cincinnati Red Stockings. Smith started his professional career in the mid-1870s. Although he was the property of the Cincinnati Major League team, he wasn't used for any of their regular season games. His playing time was apparently confined to exhibition games, which were played a lot during those seasons and action with area independent teams. Even so, Smith's play in Cincinnati was enough to get him noticed, and he spent the next few seasons in cities that would later have major league or at least strong minor league teams. He played for the Baltimore Blues in 1878 and 79, and in Nashville in 1880. He then returned to Indiana, spending 1881 with Terre Haute and the next two seasons with Indianapolis, both part of what were called the Northwestern League. In 1884, Indianapolis finally got its own major league team, but Smith didn't make the cut. He did, however, stay in the area and play for a team in Noblesville that year. Then in 1885, he played for clubs in Jacksonville, Florida, and in Greencastle in Evansville, Indiana. Well, during the early 1880s, Charles's parents, John and Rebecca, separated, though they apparently remained married. Rebecca Smith and three of her children moved west to Illinois, first to Danville, then Mattoon, and finally to Decatur. Charles, who'd been living with a married sister in Indianapolis, followed his mother to Decatur in 1886 and was recruited to play for the local team. The Decatur White Stockings had dreams of being the best independent professional baseball club in the region in 1886, and they largely succeeded. Manager Al Morgan had scouts searching the Midwest for great players, and one even came from as far away as Philadelphia. At least three members of the team that year had previously or would later play in the major leagues, including Charles Smith. Blue and white uniforms, identical to those worn by the Chicago White Stockings, were purchased and a new grandstand was constructed for the baseball diamond located in Oakland Park. The season opener took place on May 24th against a team from DuQuoin, who were then considered, quote, the champions of Southern Illinois. Smith was used in the outfield that day, but attracted notice at the plate, where he doubled in a pair of runs and tripled and scored on a throwing error. The following day, Smith played third base, and then on the final game in the series, he made his pitching debut, allowing only four hits and leading the team to an easy 17-5 victory. In the early part of the 1886 season, Smith was more valuable behind the plate than in the pitcher's box. Now, this was before there was a mound. But once his hitting streak cooled off, he became the team's most valuable pitcher. He even pitched against the St. Louis Browns in an exhibition game that summer. And even though the Major League Browns hammered the Decatur team 25-2, Smith pitched well. Al Morgan had wanted to sharpen his team's play against strong competition, so he told Browns manager Charles Comiskey not to go easy on them. Well, they didn't. On June 28th, he pitched a 10-6 victory against the Springfield Reds, which earned him favorable mention in the local newspapers. There was also a note made about Smith receiving a bouquet of flowers from an admiring friend at the end of the game. Now, no mention of the friend's identity was made, but it was undoubtedly a woman, and while it might have been Maggie Buechert, his future wife, it really could have been any number of women in town. Smith had already gained many admirers in Decatur, especially ladies. He was a smooth talker, a flashy dresser, had traveled all over the country, and was famous for his large, waxed handlebar mustache. Smith loved to have a good time, and he loved to drink. When he wasn't on the baseball field, he was on a stool in a local tavern or out on the town with one of his female friends. Well, the day after the Springfield win, he was even better with a 4-2 victory over the Central Club of St. Louis. Both Decatur papers raved about his performance. He beat the Centrals again the next day, too. Then, on a scheduled day off, he pitched again, called in from the outfield to replace the injured starter in the July 3rd game. Although pitching every other day was common then, four appearances in five games over a six-day span was pretty unusual, even for 1886. Even so, Smith was ready and willing to start in both games of a July 5th doubleheader. Smith continued to pitch through that summer, going up against the Prickly Ash Club from St. Louis, which was recognized as the champion amateur club in the city after beating all of the other St. Louis teams. Smith pitched against them twice, winning one and losing the other, and the games started a rivalry that would attract national attention by the fall. Finding decent competition for an independent team like Decatur was tough in the 19th century. They were generally too good for most of their opponents, but not good enough against major league teams, which was again the case when Baltimore, who was the American Association's worst team that year, visited Decatur. The White Stockings were trailing 11-2 after six innings when Smith came in from right field to finish the game. But no matter how good he was, it wasn't enough, and Decatur lost to the Orioles. But they won the next four games, two against Christian Brothers College in St. Louis and two against Greencastle, Indiana. More importantly, well, to the newspapers anyway, were the new uniforms that had been purchased for the team. They were gold and trimmed in maroon with maroon socks and golden maroon striped hats. Not surprisingly, the team was often referred to as the Maroons after that, since, let's be honest, it didn't make much sense to call them the White Stockings anymore. Anyway, soon after scoring the new uniforms, the team went on a month-long road trip, playing teams across the Northwestern League with games in Northern Illinois, Wisconsin, and Indiana, unfortunately losing more than they won. Well, at the homecoming game in August, Smith started against Boston, a National League team. They'd stopped in Decatur after finishing a series in Detroit. And like the other times that Decatur played against a major league team, Boston, quote, "mopped up the ground with our yellow-suited boys," wrote one newspaper. They didn't even bother to give a play-by-play, probably because the final score was 28-1. As the 1886 season wound down, Decatur played some of its best baseball. They trounced the Evansville, Indiana team twice, with Smith facing off against future major league pitcher Red Arrett. But then came the really important game, a rematch with the Prickly Ash Club in St. Louis. The game was scheduled for September 12th at St. Louis's Union Park. The newspapers printed stories about the managers from the two teams wagering $100 on the outcome, with the St. Louis-based but nationally known Sporting News holding on to the bets. There was excitement across the Midwest and then beyond, with heavy bets being taken in major cities. A special excursion train left St. Louis at 7:30 a.m. on that Sunday morning, carrying the team and about 200 fans. The Sporting News reported that while Decatur fans didn't bring any tin horns or trumpets with them to the game, they made a lot of noise and had no trouble shouting down the opposition. Good old Decatur. Total attendance of the game was estimated at between 2,000 and 3,000 people. Albert Spink of the Sporting News was among the dozens of reporters who came to the city for the game, and he featured it on the front page of the Sporting News on the September 20th issue. Smith was one of Decatur's stars that afternoon, which ended in a 6-1 victory. Reporters called Smith's fastball formidable and praised his spectacular defensive play. Albert Spink watched him closely, and if Smith made seven assists and six strikeouts, he loudly exclaimed, "That's the way to play ball!" The Decatur team came home to a celebration. When the train arrived at the station just after midnight, the Goodman Brass Band and a large crowd were waiting to greet them. Three open carriages were also waiting at the platform, and they carried the team to the town square. People waved at them from windows along the route despite the late hour, and on the square there was more music, three cheers from the crowds, and girls who lined up to kiss the winners. Smith was given the game ball, and as one reporter wrote, quote, "he wouldn't have taken a farm for it." In September 1886, Charles Smith was Decatur's greatest hero. Almost exactly 9 years later, though, he would be its greatest villain. Players from the 1886 Decatur team attracted attention from other professional teams, and Smith was no exception. He finished the 1886 season playing for a team in Little Rock, Arkansas, and began the 1887 season with Memphis in the Southern League. Later that season, he played one game in Nashville, pitched in Champaign, Illinois, and then pitched for Wichita, Kansas in the Western League. Now, there are no records to say why he moved so many times that season, but there were rumors he'd had some trouble off the field. Not only was he drinking more, but he'd had a few brushes with the law as well. He became too big of a problem for teams who wanted to keep him on. Even back in Decatur, he'd been arrested a few times and suspected of crimes that included burglary, larceny, assault, and illegal gambling. His popularity in the city, though, kept him out of jail. He didn't have anyone protecting him now, so he kept moving from town to town, finally returning to Decatur in 1888. That season, Decatur helped form the new Central Interstate League, and the local team was a mixture of young players such as future major leaguer Jerry Harrington and veterans like Charles Smith, who was now 34 years old. The first games were in Lafayette and Logansport, Indiana, and newspapers there called Smith, quote, the Decatur Twirler, and said his pitching was terrific. It was during this season that Smith earned his nickname of Pacer. A teammate later recalled that Smith had a habit when at bat of waiting for balls to be thrown so he could just take a base. Then he would amble down to first in an odd manner that his friends said looked like the pace of a horse. A reporter from the Pantograph in Bloomington, Illinois, first noticed this oddity at a game there and dubbed him Pacer Smith, and the name stuck. Smith's 1886 season in Decatur had been great, but 1888 turned out to be the opposite. Poor organization handicapped both the new league and the team. They lost 7 straight games to open the season and quickly fell into last place. Press comments were generally favorable about Smith's pitching, though, and he finally won his first game on May 16th against Bloomington, 8-6. Team morale was low after all those losses, though, and it wasn't long before teammates and managers were at one another's throats. When the team was in Dubuque, Iowa, manager Michael Hurley sent a telegram to one of Decatur's newspapers accusing Smith and another player of, quote, stupid base running. I'm not sure exactly what that is, but apparently someone did. Anyway, the newspaper blasted the manager and the telegram he'd sent. The sports editor wrote, Smith is never stupid in ball playing or base running. No one has ever accused him of stupidity before. The stupid telegram is a mean charge and may prove to be a boomerang. And they were right. Hurley's telegram earned him nothing but dislike from the players, and he left the team at the end of May. Soon after that, the team disbanded, and Smith and the rest of the players were left without jobs. When not spending time in local taverns, Smith looked for work and ended up pitching for the Bloomington team for a while and then finished the 1888 season in Effingham, Illinois, where he also worked as a fireman for the Vandalia Railroad. On the evening of Wednesday, December 26th, he married Maggie Buchard at the California Hotel in Effingham. Maggie was also from Decatur, so newspapers there carried the story, and it wasn't necessarily a good one. The Review reported that Maggie's parents, quote, had protested for some time against her friendliness for Smith and had positively refused to consent to their marriage. Well, they got married anyway, and Maggie spent the winter with her husband in Effingham and then went with him to Elkhart, Indiana, where he pitched for the local team in 1889 until it disbanded. He finished the season playing for teams in Monmouth, Illinois and Fort Madison, Iowa. The couple was reportedly very happy that first year, but that happiness wouldn't last. Although his pitching skills were in decline, Pacer Smith had one last strong season in 1890 when he played for Ottawa, Illinois. A Decatur newspaper, I think a little jealously, wrote, quote, the Ottawa people went wild over him. He was banqueted and was a social pet. The citizens presented him with an elegant gold watch and $75. The Ottawa papers have lauded him to the skies and said he had splendid control of the ball and the best headwork of any pitchers in the league. Well, Smith was so well liked that season that when a cigar manufacturer decided to put out a new brand of cigars, they called it the Pacer Smith and put a portrait of him on the label wearing his baseball uniform. But the season and the good times came to an end. Later in 1890, Maggie gave birth to a baby girl named Louise, and this was at about the same time that Smith's drinking became worse. He and Maggie separated about a month after Louise was born, and Maggie moved back to her parents' home in Decatur. He sometimes visited his family and sent a little money, but the money never added up to much. He began the 1891 season in the Wisconsin State League, but didn't last long there. He drifted back to Decatur, where he pitched for a semi-professional team for a while. By now, he was considered unreliable by most reputable teams, but still managed to play for a club in Pena, Illinois the next season, where he also served as a town policeman. When the season ended, he tried to become an electrician, but unsuccessful at that, he returned to baseball one last time, spending the 1893 season playing for several semi-professional teams in Indiana. By then, his drinking was out of control, and he never played baseball again. Smith returned to Decatur and moved into his mother's house. He needed work, but his drinking often prevented him from holding a position for long. And that's unfortunate, because Smith had the skills to make a decent living after baseball. He was a dog lover, and he'd spent a lot of time training hunting dogs, but failed to pursue it. He was also an excellent cook, which earned him many jobs, most of which he subsequently lost. The only job he seemed to excel at was as a bartender, a common occupation for former players with a fondness for alcohol. Being back in Decatur, Smith visited Maggie and Louise often. They were still living with Maggie's parents on East Lawrence Street. His drinking grew steadily worse, though, and often when he visited, he was prone to angry outbursts. Once he'd reportedly threatened his wife after she refused to consider reconciling with him. Smith marched off, headed for the closest tavern where he tried to drink away his troubles. But he failed, and it would soon be alcohol that ruined him for good. On Saturday, September 28, 1895, Smith spent the entire day drinking in a downtown saloon. He was a regular customer, so he had little trouble convincing the bartender, Michael Dugan, to loan him his .38 caliber revolver. Smith told him he needed to shoot a dog with distemper. Dugan would later say that Smith seemed to be in an ordinary frame of mind when he left with that gun. Smith left the tavern and walked to the home of his father-in-law, Frank Buchard, where Maggie and Louise lived, along with Maggie's 17-year-old sister, Edna. When he arrived, he asked for his daughter, but she wasn't there. Louise, who was 5 years old by this time, was playing with friends in a neighbor's yard. Edna offered to go and get her and went off down the street, leaving Smith waiting on the front porch. Witnesses later testified that Smith never gave any inclination that he was upset about anything or that he planned to kill anyone. The house where the Buchard family lived was a one-story frame structure with a high front porch. When Edna returned with Louise, they sat down on the porch steps together. Smith was standing nearby, and Maggie had come out of the house to visit. She was standing on the steps a few feet away from her husband. The last thing she remembered was Smith standing there, smiling at her. And then suddenly, and without any warning, he removed the borrowed revolver from his coat and fired it at his daughter. The bullet struck Louise in the neck, and she made a loud choking cry as she pitched forward and rolled down the stairs to land at her father's feet. Maggie and Edna, utterly terrified, screamed and scrambled up the steps and away from the gun. Smith fired a second shot at Maggie, and it narrowly missed her, lodging in the ceiling of the front porch. She began to scream for help, running away from the house and in the direction of the Jacobs Butcher Shop, where her father worked, a half block away. What exactly happened to Edna next will never be known. Smith was the only witness, and he never spoke of it. The only thing that is certain is that Smith turned his gun on her and fired another shot. Now, she was not struck while on the front steps, though. Edna was hit near the back door of the house. She'd apparently run all the way around the east side with Smith in pursuit, and then he fired. She staggered back to the front walk where she collapsed. Her father found her there, covered in blood, a short time later. While this was happening, Maggie was bursting through the door of the butcher shop, and she screamed, "Charlie has shot Louise!" Frank Buchert immediately ran to his house where he discovered Edna on the sidewalk. Frank dropped to his knees and pulled Edna to him in a grief-stricken embrace. He called her name several times, but it was too late. The young woman was already dead. Frank looked up and saw Smith standing a short distance away. He was coldly looking over the scene, the revolver still in his hand. Frank pleaded with Smith to tell him why he'd done such a terrible thing. Well, Smith snarled back at him. "You be a little careful, or I'll give you your own dose of lead," he said to his father-in-law. Frank laid Edna's body carefully on the ground, and his hand stained red by his daughter's blood, ran to the fallen body of his granddaughter. Louise was unconscious but still alive, although she was bleeding badly. He picked her up and carried her into the house and gently placed her on a bed. By this time, neighbors had started to gather, and one of the men carried Edna's body into the house too and placed her on the couch in the living room. With one last look at the Buchert house, Pacer Smith walked calmly and slowly down the street in the direction of the butcher shop, possibly looking for his wife. If he'd tried to enter the shop, though, this story would have come to a quick end. Mrs. Jacobs told her husband to kill Smith if he tried to enter the store. He loaded his gun and waited, but Smith walked on past. After making a telephone call to the police, he got into his buggy and followed after him down the street. Well, the police, aware of the details of the crime but unaware of the identity of the killer, were soon on the way. Deputy Sheriff Frank Taylor and Patrolman Oscar Cross ran into Mr. Jacobs at Clay Street. They asked him who had committed the crime. "Pacer Smith," he replied, "and there he goes." Moments later, they saw Smith heading into a nearby alley, and both officers jumped from their buggy and ran toward him, just in time to see him disappear into a yard. Both men drew their revolvers, expecting a fight as they advanced on his spot. As the officers rounded the corner of the house, though, they were surprised to see Smith walking toward them. He held the revolver in his right hand, and when Cross grabbed hold of him, he released it. He offered no resistance, and when Cross asked him why he'd done it, his only reply was that, quote, "he'd had lots of trouble, and he finally put an end to it all." Chief Mason and Officer Howard Williams also arrived on the scene a few moments later and helped take Smith into custody. He was taken to the jail, and within 30 minutes of the murder, the killer was behind bars. Smith was charged with Edna Buchert's killing. He was charged with a second murder on Monday morning when Louise also died from her wound. At first, it seemed like she might survive, but early in the morning of September 20th, she took a turn for the worse and passed away around 7 a.m. Edna and Louise were buried together in a single grave. Word quickly spread throughout Decatur about the brutal murders and about the famous killer. The excitement was intense, and lynching was freely spoken of on the streets and in the taverns and saloons. Even police officers were upset and angry over the crime. Officer Brockway, who was described as, quote, "one of the oldest and most reliable men on the police force," rushed at Smith when he was first brought to the jail and tried to attack him with his billy club. Other officers restrained him, but they did so reluctantly. Brockway was the uncle of Maggie and Edna Buchert, and only the cooler heads of the other officers kept him from killing Smith with his bare hands. Shortly after Smith was locked up, he was interrogated by Sheriff J.P. Nicholson. On Saturday night, though, he refused to talk. His replies to questions that were asked by Nicholson were disjointed and strange. Nicholson asked, "What was the matter with you today, Pacer?" Smith replied, "What have I done? I don't know what you mean." Well, at that, Nicholson became angry. "Don't attempt that. You haven't got sense enough to play crazy. You'd better fess up and tell the whole story, and it'll go better for you." But Smith just shook his head and refused to explain the reasons behind what he'd done. "I've had lots of trouble, but it's all over now. I'm sick now, but I'll tell you about it tomorrow," he said to the sheriff. The newspapers reported that Smith became sick that night and his, quote, "entire faculties seemed to collapse." The police feared that he was being seized by delirium from alcohol. I mean, everyone was aware of his heavy drinking. But the next morning, he seemed to rally and his health improved. Despite this, he never kept his promise to Sheriff Nicholson and refused to explain why he had shot Louise and Edna. In fact, his only regret over the course of the next few days was that he had been unable to kill his wife. Smith, when interviewed by reporters, seemed detached and indifferent about the murders. He claimed he'd mistaken his sister-in-law for his wife, and in his version of events, he referred to Louise as the kid or the baby, but didn't refer to her by her name. He claimed to be hazy about what had occurred. An inquest was held on the day that Louise died, and a grand jury indicted Smith for both murders. That afternoon, he was taken into court and arraigned for trial. Attorneys Bunn and Park were appointed to defend him, but they asked to be excused, and I.A. Buckingham was appointed in their place. On October 7th, the trial was held, and Smith entered a guilty plea for the murder of Louise. However, he stated he was not guilty for Edna's murder. Apparently believing that since he'd meant to kill his wife, not his sister-in-law, he was less accountable for that crime. Well, needless to say, it doesn't work that way. Assistant State's Attorney A.H. Mills presented the case for the state. Michael Dugan testified he'd loaned Smith the murder weapon. Mr. and Mrs. Jacobs testified next. When Frank Buchert took the stand, he spoke emotionally about the crime, his daughter's marriage, and the way that it had fallen apart. Deputy Taylor and Officer Cross were also called, as well as the reporter who'd interviewed Smith. Sheriff Nicholson testified about the statements that Smith had made to him after his arrest. Well, after hearing from the witnesses, Judge Vail asked Smith's attorney if he had a statement he wanted to make on behalf of his client. Buckingham and Smith held a whispered conversation for a few moments, and then Smith stood and asked to speak. He spoke quietly and was sometimes difficult to hear as he made his statement. I borrowed the gun and I went down there to kill the lady and the child, my wife. I understood that if I pled guilty that I would be hung, and I'm willing to do it, but would like to have it put off until the 16th of February. Apparently, he was supposed to inherit some property that day, although I'm not sure what good that would do him. But then he added, I am willing to face anybody and everybody. Smith then took his seat again and wiped the perspiration that had beaded on his forehead with a black silk handkerchief. The judge asked Buckingham if he had anything he wanted to add, and the attorney stated that he didn't. Judge Vail then spoke. There is not, to my mind, any excuse whatever for the willful, intentional killing of a child who could not, in the nature of things, cause anyone to harbor ill feeling toward her. And in my judgment, this is a case where justice demands the extreme penalty of the law. The judge asked Smith if there were any extenuating circumstances that he believed justified the murders, but Smith only shook his head. The reason he killed his daughter, tried to kill his wife, and killed his sister-in-law instead was never revealed. The judge then ordered Smith to stand as he passed sentence. It is the sentence of this court that you be taken back to the Macon County Jail and there be securely confined until the 29th day of November, when you shall be taken out and hanged by the neck until dead. During the pronouncement of the sentence, Smith stared silently at the judge. He stood completely still, a blank expression on his face. It was not until the judge was finished that color came back into his skin. He slumped in what seemed to be relief, bowed his head, and whispered two words. Thank you. The silence of the courtroom was shattered by the piercing tones of a woman's voice. A murmur of approval rippled through the courtroom as Maggie Smith cried out, Thank God he's got what he deserved, but my baby, oh my baby. Many of those in attendance that day later stated they would never forget her words or the crushing grief that could be heard in her voice. Smith was hustled out of the courtroom and the crowd parted as he walked out between Sheriff Nicholson and Deputy Holmes. As he passed a group of his friends from the taverns, he made the motion of putting a rope around his neck and pretended to pull it tight. He laughed. The 29th of November, boys. When he was outside, he told the sheriff he was perfectly happy with the sentence and only feared he would be given a life sentence in the penitentiary instead. Apparently, his worries about February 16th had been forgotten. Smith was removed from his common cell at the jail that afternoon and taken to a solitary cell on the top floor of the building. During the last few weeks of his life, Smith converted to Catholicism and was visited often by Father Charles Brady, the assistant pastor of St. Patrick's Church. About 2 weeks before the hanging, he was placed on death watch, which meant that he was constantly kept under guard. Deputy Sam Stabler performed the duty during the daytime, and Tom Richardson stayed with Smith at night. Smith grew especially fond of Stabler and often spoke of him to reporters. Shortly before his death, he told one newspaper reporter, "The sheriff has been just as kind to me as I could wish. Anything I want, I get. A man could not treat a guest better than Sheriff Nicholson treats me. Sam Stabler is all right, too. He's the same old fella every day, and we get along all right." Thursday, November 28th, was Smith's last full day alive and his last Thanksgiving. He was in good spirits. He visited with his priest and his family and ate a hearty dinner of turkey with oyster dressing, gravy, sweet and Irish potatoes, a piece of pie, and a large glass of milk. His elderly father, John, traveled from his home in Indianapolis to see his son one last time. And Smith's mother, brothers, and several sisters stayed with him in his cell for several hours. When his mother started to leave, she collapsed with grief and had to be escorted out by the officers on duty. Around 3 p.m. that day, one of his brothers, J.E. Smith, went to the Buchert home and tried to convince Maggie and Frank to come to the jail and see Smith one last time. Both refused. Father Brady stayed with Smith throughout the remainder of the day and promised to return the next morning with Father Higgins of Taylorville to give Smith communion one final time. Smith rose early on the morning of November 29th. He ate breakfast and then took a short nap at his cell. He told reporters he did this so he'd feel rested and better about his ordeal at noon. He then met with Father Brady and Father Higgins and said a final goodbye to his family members. Meanwhile, Sheriff Nicholson was dealing with a chaotic scene inside and outside the jail. Hundreds of curiosity seekers were trying to get a look at the gallows and had to be escorted away. Only those who held one of the 300 tickets that were given out would be able to witness the hanging. And they began arriving at 11 a.m. and were allowed into the jail yard where the gallows stood. Shortly afterward, Maggie's brother Lewis arrived at the jail to deliver a last message to Pacer Smith from his wife. There's no record of what the message said, but it seems unlikely that it was one of forgiveness. Just before noon, Sheriff Nicholson came to Smith's cell and read aloud his death warrant. Father Brady and Father Higgins stood nearby, and Smith listened calmly. The sheriff then led the procession to the jail yard. And as they climbed the stairs, reporters noted that Smith seemed, quote, pale but determined. The two priests prayed with him one final time, and then the hood and the noose were slipped over his head. Under the platform, three doctors waited to pronounce Smith dead. Sheriff Nicholson asked Smith if he'd had any last words, and Pacer paused for a moment before he finally spoke in a quiet voice. "I am truly sorry for all I have done," he said. Deputy Holmes tied his arms and legs, and Deputy Stabler adjusted the noose, making sure it was in the correct place. As he removed his hands from the knot, Holmes spoke up. "Goodbye, Charlie," he said to Smith, who wished him farewell, his voice muffled by the black hood over his head. Sheriff Nicholson pulled back on the bar that held the trapdoor in place, and it opened with a dull rattle and a jolt. Smith fell. His body quivered a moment as the rope was drawn tight, his neck snapped, and his head tilted to the right. 6 minutes later, Charles Pacer Smith was pronounced dead. And this turned out to be the last public hanging in Decatur history. To everyone who spoke to him, prayed with him, or stood guard outside his cell in his final days, it seemed clear that Charles Smith wanted to die for the crimes he'd committed. He never revealed what led him to kill his daughter and to try and kill his wife, shooting Edna instead. Whatever the reason, he seemed to believe that death was the only thing that could ease his conscience and relieve his guilt. But was death enough to allow him to find peace? Well, according to the rest of Pacer Smith's story, it wasn't. After Smith's body was removed from the gallows, it was taken to the Martin Funeral Parlor and then delivered to his mother's house for the wake. A funeral service was held the following day at St. Patrick's Church, and Smith was buried in an unmarked grave at Calvary Cemetery, the city's Catholic burial ground on West El Dorado Street. Most of the pallbearers were his former teammates. For years after his burial, legends say that Smith's ghost was seen walking through the cemetery, recognizable in the gold and maroon baseball uniform that he wore when he was one of the great heroes of the city. The stories say he simply refused to rest in peace, still tormented, even in death, by the murders he committed in life, and the fact that he took the reason for those murders with him to the grave. But this is not the only place that became haunted by Smith's crimes. The story of his apparition wandering the cemetery faded with time, but the haunting that occurs at the house on East Lawrence Street, where Louise and Edna died, that one refuses to end. Witnesses say that the ghostly screams of a woman have been heard outside the house for decades, followed by the pounding of footsteps on the front porch. Others haven't just heard the ghost, they've seen her too. She's a young woman, they say, wearing an old-fashioned dress, who runs across the front of the house, disappears around the corner, and then reappears on the other side, where she stumbles and falls to the sidewalk before vanishing. While most of those who live in that neighborhood today have no idea who this spectral woman might be, it's obvious to those who know the house's history that she's the spirit of Edna Bucher, still running for her life and fleeing from her crazed and murderous brother-in-law after all this time. How long her desperate run will continue is unknown, because even now, all these years later, she seems unable or unwilling to stop and finally be able to rest. Stay with us for the rest of the show and find out how you can be part of an upcoming episode after enjoying these important messages from our sponsors.
Have you ever tried to run your own online store? I definitely have. Check out AmericanHauntedClothing.com, always be plugging. And I'm not going to lie, after a long day of work at the podcast factory, sometimes the store can be a chore. But that's where Shopify comes in. Yep, that sound means another sale. Shopify's point-of-sale system is a unified command center for your retail business. It brings together in-store and online operations, even across 1,000 locations. So even if you're out ghost hunting or whatever it is that you do in your spare time, I don't know exactly what it is that you do, but if you're like us, you can rest assured that Shopify has your sales efforts covered. Because when I'm out in the field, or Troy has somehow convinced me to check out the spooky basement or some building with traumatic history, I don't even have to think about my online store, because Shopify guarantees that shopping is just always convenient. Endless aisle, ship to customer, buy online, pick up in store. All made simpler so customers can shop how and where they want. And staff have the tools they need to close a sale every time. Want more? Check out Shopify.com/hauntings, all lowercase, and learn how to create the best retail experiences without complexity. That's Shopify.com/hauntings. Troy, can we stop with the shirt sale for... Troy, I gotta finish this ad. No, I just need a second.
Your Honor, we the jury find the defendant Sweet Tango Apples guilty on all counts of being the crispiest, sweetest, zestiest, most delicious tasting apple you can buy.
Order! Order in this courtroom! Bailiff, come back here. Where are you going?
I'm going with them. I want some Sweet Tango Apples too.
You love a great mystery, but not in the produce aisle. Be sure to reach for Sweet Tango, the most delicious tasting apple money can buy. Investigate where you can get yours at SweetTango.com.
All right, well, I am ready when you are then, yeah.
Okay.
So thanks for tuning in. I just wanted to fuck.
Oh, I'm like, what?
In the morning.
Did I miss something? Okay. Welcome back to American Hauntings, and thanks to all who've joined us for episode number 19 of our latest season. My name is Troy Taylor. I'm the creator of American Hauntings, and I wrote and narrated this episode just before heading down to the local baseball park for a game. I've heard the White Stockings have a hot new pitcher this season, and I know my friend, editor, producer, and co-host Cody Beck wants to check it out. So I'll grab the hot dogs and Cracker Jacks before he gets there. Oh, there he is now. Hey, Cody.
So of all the
sports ball episode,
so of all the episodes where you don't do the Cody, this
yeah,
is
I
the
know
one.
This is the one I know, but they didn't have announcers like that in the 1800s.
Okay, so. that is fair.
I was trying to be historically accurate.
Okay, actually, I hadn't thought about that before. So when somebody's going up to bat or on deck or whatever, like. What did they do? Did they have megaphones? Did they have
that's a good question. Maybe people didn't care that much back then.
Maybe they didn't.
So I guess they must have, because I mean he was like a local hero, but maybe it wasn't like a star kind of thing yet.
Maybe that's why numbers were so important.
1880s. Yeah, probably.
So important.
Yeah, probably. So yeah, yeah, I don't know about that. Yeah, I guess I could have got a megaphone or something.
That's what I was thinking. Yeah, maybe they had.
Yeah, I know. I've let everybody down already.
It's okay. No, Troy, you never let me down. I thought of all episodes, this would be the one.
I know.
But also you're right. Staying true to the time.
No, not really. I just forgot.
Troy, I'm trying to give you every out.
I know. It's okay.
Anyway, hey, I woke up this morning. It was 45 degrees outside.
I know. It's nice, isn't it?
It's like fall is like.
I know. Finally. Yeah. Because it was 90 the other day.
So, yeah. So what's going on? I know people think that we only do stuff during the fall and stuff, but like we don't. But now is
no,
like.
No. But now is. But of course, you know, now, you know, most things are full. So,
of course,
you know, one of the few things I have left is the and I think it's only because it's a Thursday, but. Gosh, it's Halloween. I mean, you can give up like an hour, and it's not even going to be that late because it starts at 7. So, the Houdini seance on Halloween night is going to be a lot of fun, and beautiful. I'm really looking forward to it. And we are just over half full, so we're getting there. So it's gonna fill up. So if you'd like to join us. Go to dinnerandspirits.com and you can sign up for it. You'll see as you look at October, that's the only thing not sold out. And then a lot of November already is too, but we do still have some stuff in November and December. And we've also posted our winter and spring schedule all the way through June. So there's a lot of new stuff up there. Yeah. Yeah. Just brand new stuff we just added. So all of it's at dinnerandspirits.com. Of course, the Dead of Winter event is coming up. We've talked about that already. But just as a reminder, you can go to AmericanHauntings.net. We are almost out of VIP packages, at least the one with lunch. And we're almost out of spots for one of the after hour events. So I encourage people. I know it seems like February, actually, it's February 1st. So it's really not that far off. But it's time to grab those tickets if you want to do the after hour stuff. If you're just coming to the daytime event, you just need your canned goods and, you know, that kind of thing. We're also going to be partnering with the warming shelter here in town, too.
Oh, beautiful.
With the warming shelter and with the food bank. So,
awesome.
Yeah, so it's going to be a nice winter event at the Best Western Premiere.
And it's also it's the one time a year that we so far do a live podcast as well.
Like it is. Yeah. In front of people. A lot of disappointed people, but still
mostly disappointed people.
Yeah. But, you know, it's still fun for us anyway. So also American Oddities Museum. We're open every weekend. We have a pop up this weekend with River City Oddities is coming in. It's a taxidermy. She does a lot of really cool stuff, mostly with like insects, butterflies, that kind of stuff.
Oh, nice.
That she's going to be in this weekend, this Saturday, the 19th. And then the weekend after, my son Oren will be here with his art doing a pop-up, and his wife Rachel will be here with her pottery. And I've actually had people asking about that.
So they
must be
cool
seeing it
stuff
online. Yeah. Yeah. So they will be doing a pop-up on the 26th. And then we will be open Halloween day. So we're going to be open Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, Halloween weekend. So we're adding an extra day. And
that's
so
awesome.
People can come by on Halloween. And if you come in wearing a costume, on Halloween Day. Just that's cool.
Yeah, be careful.
Oh, I didn't. About. You were waiting for me to present him with something, but
no, I was.
Awesome. So
but I was
Trey would appreciate it, I'm sure. So
I was just thinking, yeah, be careful what you're wearing. Just as far as like, don't come in with a ski mask and gloves.
Yeah, don't like, do that. Yeah,
oh, I'm pretending that, so. To be a bank robber.
Yeah,
well, no, but also
get you very far. But
I have a. Well, there's a vault, but I have an original Oren piece in my apartment, and everybody that sees it, they're like, "What's that?" And I'm like, "You need to worry about that."
Yeah, let me tell you a story.
Yeah, but it's awesome. So that's awesome. I'm glad that we got a lot of things going on and stuff's happening and some great partnerships and things and
absolutely. Yeah,
that's awesome. We also have some other stuff going on as far as the Patreon season. And I wanted to give a quick shout out to our new subscribers on Patreon. So thank you so much for supporting the show to Jennifer, Elizabeth, and Natalie. And Troy, where are you at with this one? And what do you got next? Can you tell us yet?
Our Patreon program is an alternate podcast to this one. We have three seasons so far, and we are almost finished. We are at today. We posted our second to last episode in our Ed Gein Texas Chainsaw season. So we only have one more episode left of that. It'll be posted up later this month. But if you are a follower on Patreon, you get a new show every week. And then we'll be starting season 5 of that alternate podcast. I may start it before the first of the year. Usually we wait and hold off during Christmas, but I haven't decided yet. I do need to take a little time to get coordinated with the next episode. I know what it is, but I've got to get organized. But anyway, if you're interested in those other shows or just being a supporter of Patreon, which kind of keeps this show propped up that we do for free, it's patreon.com/AmericanHauntings. So we would love to have you on board for that. So
awesome. Well, before we get started, I just have one listener review that I wanted to go through. And this one is from Eli Die. I don't know. it's titled Good Outro. I said, good day. I love listening to y'all's show. I'm on season 3, episode 8. Cody, you are being heard. I know back in season 3, I'm sure we were doing some crazy.
Oh, I'm sure too, because wasn't that 2020?
Yeah, it was a lot. Yeah.
Well, I don't think it was. It wasn't yet.
I think we were going crazy.
Yeah.
The outro is important, but I love the teasing and banter. It keeps me tuned in to the very end. I thoroughly enjoy the show. The history is awesome and the legends are great. The relationship between y'all makes it seem like you've known each other for a lifetime. Thank you.
It just seems like it.
It just seems like we just got used to giving each other shit real quick.
Yeah, we did.
So thank you so much for that review. Okay, so is this our first sports themed episode?
I think so. I know there was something. It must have just been me doing it. I remember someone writing us a text or something or a message and saying something about doing something about sports ball, but it was probably because, you know, me and
sports, you do the sports ball thing.
Yeah,
sports.
I only watch the Bears and that's it. So nothing else. usually, except for this year, they're usually disappointing us by like September.
Sure.
So I stop or at least half-assed watch, but better this year. Anyway, I don't do a lot of sports stuff. So this really is our last one, or I should say our last one, but definitely our first one.
Yeah.
I don't think I've done any others.
Did you play any sports growing up, even as a young type?
Just some football.
Football.
Yeah, not what very position? Well. No, I don't want to talk about it.
Okay. All right. Never mind.
I'm still limping. So,
oh gosh. Okay. Yeah. So I love sports. I love sports growing up. I was really, really good at baseball and soccer way before everybody else was. And then they all caught up to me and then I didn't go any further. So it was cool for me for like 4 years when we were little people.
Yeah.
And then I just got wrecked after that. But, I like sports enough to keep up with it to have some conversations. I love like sports highlights, you know, those like Facebook videos that'll hit.
Oh, sure. Sure.
Like, cause I just like the athleticism.
Well, you know what I love about sports though? Sports movies. About sports.
Moneyball.
All of them. I don't think there's been very many that I don't like. They're just fun to watch. I love baseball movies.
A lot of them are
great. Don't really.
Rudy's a great movie. Yeah.
I mean, every once in a while, I'll go to a baseball game in St. Louis just because it's close and it's kind of fun, even though, boy, did they suck.
Yeah.
But, you know, I love baseball movies. Mm. Major League, one of my favorite comedies of all time.
It's Field so of Dreams, funny. Fantasy.
At Bull Durham. Mm-hmm. Oh, man, I've watched that movie so many times.
So many Kevin Costner.
I've even read the movies. Book about making of. Yeah, The Perfect Game. You ever seen that one?
That's
a great movie. And I love football movies, too. I don't know. I love sports movies.
Interesting.
But I'm not a big, I don't really watch sports. It's just not really my thing.
Yeah. So. I watch hockey. And I watch,
I do not watch hockey. I do not like hockey at all.
Really?
I like hockey movies, but
sure.
And it's not just because, don't say, oh, it's because you're old. I can't figure out where the puck is.
I have no idea.
I need it to be like, I might watch it if it was like constantly circled by a cartoon.
I think eventually,
you know what I mean? Or if it, like, the puck became a cartoon.
Eventually something like that's going to happen.
And then, I mean, on TV and it was a little cartoon, I could keep track of it.
Little Roadrunner or something.
Yes. Yeah, something. I don't know. Yeah. But,
I've talked
smiley about face even. I don't care. Just,
I like UFC and I like hockey because I like organized consensual violence. You like,
did you see, well, okay. I can understand that.
Yeah.
But if it was just fighting, it would be more interesting.
That's why I like the UFC.
The
part.
Long grappling stuff that no one does anything. It just seems weird and uncomfortable and it boring, frankly.
I know. Well, so you know. Troy, I have some ideas for how to make these sports better. I can fix
boxing right now. Let's go back to bare knuckle in a circle on the
people
street.
People probably wouldn't get hurt as bad because your hands would break before you kill somebody, right? But I think in hockey, after they do a shootout, if it's still a tie, you just have your two biggest guys come out and they fight and whoever wins, that's it. And then I think in football, if you dunk it over the goal post, whatever, then you don't have to kick the extra point. I don't know how this would work, but those are just,
I don't either. That one, that's a, seems a loose one there.
But it's fun.
All right. Well,
anyway, yeah, we're not sports people, as you can tell.
No, as you can tell.
But something I was thinking of when we start this, you talked about, baseball and the Pete Rose and gambling and all these different things. Why can't people bet on themselves to win? Because then it's not that they're throwing the
game. Well, no, yeah, I know you're right.
What am I not thinking of?
I'm not sure. Yeah, I'm not sure what the rules are. I mean, obviously there are.
Sure.
And I'm sure they probably got started back.
There's probably good reason
for the Black Sox scandal. 8 Men Out, by the way. Excellent film.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think that's probably what got it started with because, I mean, I can't imagine that there's been no one else who's bet on themselves.
Oh, no, of course. But I feel like if you're betting on yourself to win, it's
I guess that's always been the question I've had about Pete Rose, is that it just seemed like somebody was just out to get him to me. Mm-hmm. Like people didn't like him.
I don't know enough about it.
Didn't like him. I don't either. But I mean, if you're betting on yourself to win,
you're not going
to
throw
the problem. You're not going to throw the game. But
I guess you could pay the other team to throw it.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, there must be some rule, and I'm not sure somebody
Dude, so. They're gonna be so mad at us for not being
for not knowing
guys
and not even bothering to look because it's sports and I don't care.
Yeah, you know? I don't give a
one
shit
of those
enough.
Things. Yeah, I know. So sorry. But,
that's cool. Pacer Smith, 4th of 10 children. So that's a interesting
normal number for that time period,
right? And it's an interesting place to fall. I mean, regardless of kind of where you do with it's 10 true. Children, but he turns out to be, I mean,
well,
kind of a good ball player.
I think he was good. He's really good for the time, and there's a big difference there because I mean,
okay,
obviously, going from the 1800s into the 1900s and more organized ball,
yeah,
I think that, you know, there's a difference. And a lot of these guys I mentioned several times, you know, he played with future major leaguers and that kind mm-hmm. of thing, and technically, he was in a major league team briefly, which is still makes him professional baseball player and the first one ever executed. So,
sure.
You know, but my question is about him is that you find out that he, while was like the star of the team, obviously he had a bit of a problem all along.
Of course.
And it wasn't just the alcohol, because he was even like when he was the star of the team, there were still questions about robberies and burglaries. Yeah. And I mean, obviously, these guys weren't paid that well. I mean, sure. Hell, that's what the Black Sox scandal was about, on how badly they were paid, you know. So none of them, even back then, were, especially back then, even further back, were probably very poorly paid. Most of them probably had second jobs. So he's already kind of a bit on the dark side anyway. But in this particular case, if you look here kind of between the lines and you see mm-hmm. that he's a bright boy with a penchant for sports, but didn't play any professional ball until he was 23. What was he doing in between?
Great question.
So he's child 4 of 10, and he doesn't do anything till he's 23, at least nothing that anyone mentions. I mean, it's pretty tough to find biographies about some of these guys. Sure. There really aren't any. But this is mostly dug up from newspapers and a few reports that I found. But I mean, because I've known this story for a long time. It takes place in Decatur, so I was familiar with it. But yeah, I don't know. It just seems like, I know baseball was just really starting to become super popular when he was young. Mm-hmm. So I can see why he didn't play, organized ball that much. But what else was he doing? Makes you wonder. So
later on he was a police officer, right?
And he served as like a town marshal.
Sure.
He worked for the railroad for a long time,
so he's probably just doing other odd kind of jobs,
or committing crimes. But yeah, so I mean, he's on the Cincinnati Red Stockings, which before they were the Reds, White Sox, where the White Stockings.
I love these names.
And that kind of changed things around a bit, when things started to become more organized. But then he played ball all over the place. I mean, he was everywhere because he was trying to get on with bigger leagues and, apparently was decent, but it wasn't really until he came to Decatur and joined their team that he really became a standout, that's when he started to get a lot more attention. And we look back at that now and we think, towns like, they were playing in Decatur and Bloomington and Springfield and stuff, and you're thinking these were major teams. But everybody, I mean, there were a lot of teams back then, and so every once in a while they'd play against a major league team
and just get hammered
demolished every time, man.
Yes,
28-1 stuff, like, I mean, where do you stop the scoring?
Maybe
that's a rule that came along later too,
but that is how you kind of talked about one of the coaches, like, that is how you get better, right? Is you play
pound you into the dirt. Good idea. I mean, to see that, he told them, don't hold back on us. We want you to. And I'm like, oh, they didn't. Don't worry.
Right. And I'm going to say right now, I know somebody's going to leave a comment or be mad about Troy and I, our lack of knowledge about sports stuff. I'm going to go out there and just say, yes, we're dumb about this stuff.
So yeah.
Whatever funny quip you come up with, I'm already out ahead.
Yeah. Well, we already know that. Yeah. We don't know anything.
Yeah. So don't tell us how much we don't know.
I mean, I knew, well, I mean, well, again, like all the terminology and everything that I used in this episode, I got it all from baseball movies. I mean, I got it all from like Bob Uecker in Major League. I mean, it's not like I just have this deep knowledge of stuff. I mean, I knew about like, I don't know, I don't. I knew about
pitcher's box.
No, I knew. Well, I found that information because they didn't have a mound back then. So it was just a square that they painted kind of like the batter's box. Yeah, I thought that was really interesting.
I saw that in a newspaper
article that it was the pitcher's box. And I thought box. So I looked it up and it turns out this was before they had a mound. Yeah, it was down flat. They weren't up. Huh. They didn't have any height. So, and I knew about Albert Spink in the Sporting News because he's buried in Bell Fountain Cemetery in St. Louis.
There you go.
He's got his own mausoleum and it's cool. And I'm like, who is this guy? So I looked it up and this was years ago.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, hey, that's the Sporting News guy. I didn't know that came from St. Louis.
I'm sure I walked by.
There you go. You probably have. It's back in Mausoleum Row, or Millionaires Row,
right
in the back part of the cemetery. So
something interesting too, because I jotted down a note earlier that said what position, but then you started to go into that. But
yeah,
something one of my buddies
played all over the place. I mean, you didn't have like Well, once he started to stand out as a pitcher, then they used him as a pitcher. But before that, nobody really had set positions. You just played wherever they wanted you to play.
Right.
He played right field, left field. He played shortstop. He played third base. I mean, it was all over.
Well, so. something I hadn't really thought about before is my buddy, he told me years ago, and I played baseball with him, but he kept going. But he his name's Nick. He was telling me that he's like, yeah, a lot of outfielders, especially like center fielders, will go to be pitchers. And I was like, that seems weird to me. He goes, dude, if you can throw that ball right there all the way to home plate. Imagine if you only had like 90 feet or whatever. I was like, oh, I never really thought about that.
Yeah.
It's the arm.
Yeah, it does make sense. Yeah, that's good because, you know, I never even thought about that. Right. And they always have him in the outfield. I kept seeing, oh, well, that's why is he in the outfield? But yeah, I thought, well, they just put him everywhere. But now that totally makes sense.
Because of the arm.
Yeah.
So 1893, he's got a season playing in Indiana. Drinking gets out of control, or I guess like I imagine back then, like they're probably still smoking cigarettes like in the dugout.
I mean, they were doing that. I mean, Babe Ruth would go like, would stand up and smoke, you know, in the batter's box, and he'd go, you know, and eat like six hot dogs between, you know, innings.
That's amazing.
It's just a whole different thing back then, you know.
Right. And he moves back in with his mom. He's a dog lover. I love this because, you know, dogs are near my heart.
So, and yeah, that's when I was complaining about the fact that he really could have done something worthwhile with his time once he left baseball. You know, I mean, they used to rave about what a great cook he was, and he worked in several restaurants. Mm-hmm. But for whatever reason, at one point, and I didn't get into all of the details, but at one point he was working at a bar in town where he was making the free lunch to serve to the rummies who came in at noon. You get free food if you buy a beer. That was a common thing back then. Mm-hmm. And that was his job. And I thought, boy, you have scraped the bottom of the barrel, my friend. His last days were rough, and, you know, playing, and then, you know, after, you know, then he gets married, and then, yeah, then he's just a, he's a bum. He's so, kind of a bum.
Something about this is like, it's not only the potential that he had and could have, you know, capitalized on, but it's the lack of understanding about why he did what he did on top of that.
Exactly. Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, yeah, there are a lot of questions here that we'll never know the answer to just because of the coverage, the way that this story was covered, you know, in the first place. I mean, they really only covered the sensational aspects of everything, you know, as far as, I mean, you can go back in the newspapers now and you can find, like, you know, when he played and stuff, but you can't figure out why he would have, you know, why he didn't do something worthwhile. I mean, was he just that drunk, or was he, or is there something else to this? Because, you know, yes, he's always had this, he's gotten into trouble, but it makes you wonder if maybe just losing his baseball career and the drinking, this guy may have had like a chronic depression or something, something we, nobody understood at the time. And today we'd look at it in a different way. I mean, obviously not that he, you know, murdered his daughter and sister-in-law and tried to kill his wife. That wouldn't be it. I mean, that's to the extreme, but I mean, maybe something could have been done before it got to that point.
Yeah.
But it's obvious that the marriage lasted for about a year before things went off the rails. But that was also about the time that he really, you know, couldn't get back into baseball. His drinking had increased because he couldn't get back into baseball. I'm going to say that his marriage probably fell apart because he was depressed over the fact that he couldn't play anymore. And then he comes back to Decatur and tries to play a little bit, and nobody wants him anymore because now his pitching arm is shot. And, you know, he was being worked to death. I mean, I made a note of that early on. You don't normally pitch 5 out of 6 days. That's not normal, even back then. But
your body can't handle it.
Yeah, they wore this guy down. They wore him out. And he just kind of lost, I think, a lot of the skill that he had and tried to play, couldn't really get on anywhere, you know, played down. And I don't know if you've ever been to Pena, Illinois, but boy, if you're playing baseball in Pena, that's a pretty low rungs, man. It was just a mining town. It wasn't a bad town. It was just not anywhere where anybody's going to see you play. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
So, you know, it just, at this point, it's just, he's done. You know, he's given up. He doesn't bother to pursue anything else he's good at. And now, you know, there's rumors about him getting involved in breaking the law again,
right?
Which I don't think is anything new. But I think that could, you could also blame a lot of that on a depression as well.
Sure.
You know, so I think, but I don't know where you go with the murders.
Well, yeah.
Or
yeah.
Why he borrows a gun one day and decides to just go shoot someone.
Yeah. So let's talk
himself,
about that.
I could see.
Of course. Right.
But maybe this is, but why would he try to take it? Maybe this was a, because he never fought back. He never gave up. So well, maybe this was kind of a suicide by cop plan. I don't know. But well, why kill the that. Family to go with him? I don't get it.
So why kill the family? But then also, okay, you didn't mean to kill your sister-in-law. You're trying to kill your wife. But then he had admits no problem killing his child.
I know.
That was just yes, that's what I was intending. Yeah. What the fuck? Well,
that's what the judge harped on the most is not so much, you know, Edna, who poor girl.
Of course.
But, you know, she was only 17, so she's not almost a child.
She was herself. A girl as well. Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, that's what the judge harped on is that you've killed this little girl who's never done anything to anybody. And I don't know how you could possibly justify this.
No.
You know, and he couldn't, and he didn't try because he never revealed why he did it. He never would say. All he ever said was two different versions of, well, had a lot of problems. I don't have them anymore. I don't find his family all that problematic.
No,
I mean,
he
doesn't do any. He doesn't give them money. He doesn't visit them whenever he wants. I mean, that's about it. You know, I mean, I know there was an incident where he blew up at Maggie because. You know, he said, well, we should get back together. And she's like, no, you know, and he got mad. But I mean, is that really what he wanted? Had he decided that, you know, if she wouldn't come back to him, if he couldn't have her, then nobody would. And maybe the daughter too. I don't know. I mean, I can't, these are just, I'm just throwing stuff out there to see what sticks because we'll never have an answer to this.
Well, and the fact that he could have shot Frank and he could have killed Frank probably if he wanted to.
Oh yeah. He could have, if he'd wanted to, and he certainly had enough bullets left in his gun.
Yeah. So what the hell is going on with this? Like it doesn't make, okay. Take yourself out. Fine. But to do that, like it just doesn't. There's a certain soundness to he's like, oh, I meant to shoot my wife, but I didn't. But you know what? I'm going to plead guilty because I did mean to kill my kid. He's kind of there. Doesn't necessarily make sense or whatever. But
no, it doesn't. Right. But there. It's not like, you know, at first he's like, oh, I don't remember.
And right.
The judge is like, yeah. Or the sheriff is like, yeah, we're not going to do that. Yeah. So, that. That's not happening here.
I just wonder maybe. Oh, had he gone? Well, I guess it wouldn't have mattered if he'd gone back to the butcher's place. He might have gotten shot, but we wouldn't know any more or less.
No, we still wouldn't know why he did it. Yeah, exactly.
Even at the very end, like with the hangman's noose and all that stuff, and it was like he gave us nothing. He gave them nothing.
Nothing. Yeah, he wouldn't ever. I mean, if he ever, the only person he may have ever revealed it to was his priest, and of course he couldn't say.
Sure.
You know, but I don't even know if he did that. He didn't tell anybody else. And, you know, he seemed to actually get along okay with the guys who were guarding him. And they were all on fairly friendly terms. Even his old teammates were his pallbearers.
Right, right.
So he couldn't have been an all bad guy.
Yeah.
I mean,
I wouldn't have carried any.
Yeah, but I mean, he wouldn't have had any friends at all. Maybe they all just felt sorry for him and knew that something had happened. That he'd snapped. Or, you know what? We're only reading this from what we can glean from this.
Sure.
From the 1880s. So we don't know. There's a lot more context to all of this, I'm sure. I'm sure there were lots of other things that were said. This is only the story that we know.
I know.
But I'm not making a plea for sympathy for this.
Yes, thank you. I wanted to bring that up.
No, I'm not. I'm just saying, I just think that there's probably layers to this that might explain it better if we had been there, you know, or if it had happened more recently, you know, we would be able to look at things differently.
Troy, you and I would be like, okay, now we just want to understand why he was a piece of shit. We already
know. We get that you are, but we just need to know why.
Yeah. There's
why you would do this.
Yeah. Just unnecessary. And oh my gosh, I just can't imagine. And I was also wondering I know there's football injuries and wrestling injury. Maybe did he take a fastball to the head at one point, or was he just really depressed? Like we don't know. I don't know. I don't know how that stuff works. And then you went to so much detail in this one about the hanging that I haven't heard in a while. I know we've done some of that before, but it was like listening to you talk about it and then reading it and stuff. And I was just like, damn, I feel like I'm right there. Like I'm starting to sweat and just like, oh.
Well, the newspapers provided some details, so I decided to include them.
Yeah, of course.
I've done that on a few stories. I do that with when it's somebody who really pisses me off. I like to make sure that they, you know, that I go into detail about how they suffered, you know, except in his case, he really didn't.
Well, his neck snapped.
His neck snapped too quick. I like the ones where they strangle for 17 minutes, you know, that
as long as we know that they're guilty and they've done terrible things.
Well, we're all right. Yeah. I mean, yeah, no, not innocent people.
I know. I'm just saying when it's like this clear cut.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think I still keep going back to Frank. Like he didn't even go after the wife after that. And he could have killed more people. And for some reason he was still kind of like aggressive or at least kind of like try me, but he didn't do anything.
My guess is he was probably fairly loaded. I mean, I think he'd been drinking like all morning.
Sure. Yeah.
And so I'm going to guess, although I don't have any evidence to prove this, but I'm going to guess that Maggie and Edna looked quite a bit alike, you know, because you got to think of the time period. Everybody, the women usually wear their hair the same way.
Well, when you're hammered, too.
Dresses, yeah. And you're drunk and you see one and just shoot her or chase her around the house. Chased I don't know. He knew somebody. Too. He knew somebody ran off.
Yeah.
But maybe he didn't realize it till it was too late, you know, that he'd already shot her. So I don't know. Who knows?
It's just the thing that we always come back to. We're trying to put ourselves in the mind.
I know. And there's no way to do that because there's no way to understand this because we just can't.
And that's a good thing.
Well, yeah, no, I'm not complaining about that.
Right. Me, so. But that leads me to the ghost stories and why there would absolutely be ghost stories or something like this. Because, you know, a woman was running for her life and wasn't even the right
woman. Yeah.
Yeah. I know. I could definitely see her sticking around, probably just pissed off about, or, you know, or like,
just reenacting this happened. You know, the terror is always what I thought, you know, people talked about, they'd hear screams and then people had seen the ghost. I always just think that she's just somehow stuck, which isn't fair, obviously.
No, not at all.
That she's just sort of stuck reenacting those last moments, or, you know, it could just be just energy, you know, it could just be a memory there that's reenacting and doing it over and over again, that her terror left such an impression on the spot. I've always thought that too. I mean, it could go either way, I suppose.
So do you think with some of these residual hauntings and things that it might just be there's the memory replaying itself, but then maybe the person has actually also moved on and they're two separate things?
I think that happens a lot. I think that with most residual hauntings, you're not talking about ghosts around, you're talking about just that memory of that energy that's stuck there, you know, and it's just replaying itself.
Makes me feel
it kind of makes sense in a more, that's easier for even people who are skeptical about actual hauntings, that's a little harder or easier, I'm sorry, for them to swallow, is that it's just energy. They believe in energy. They just don't believe in ghosts, which doesn't really make sense, but whatever. Right. We'll just roll with it. And so they can believe in a residual thing a lot more than they can, you know, take something else seriously.
Right. Well, that makes me happier too, though, just to know, like, maybe somebody could move on from this terrible, tragic thing that happened.
Yeah, no kidding.
And then they're not necessarily a part of this, are not like held back by that. Oh man. Well, okay. So this is what I would say. It's now time for our Ghostwriter segment. If you have a question or comment about the world of the macabre, email us at AmericanHauntingsPodcast@gmail.com. Troy, I got a few emails, but they were mostly stories and very, very long. So I didn't want to read them, but I did want to say thank you for sending them in. But do we have any haunt line stuff?
Oh, God. We have a lot. I'm saving some of them for the movie episode because they were answering our questions about suspense and horror. So I'm going to hang on to those. But I do have some other ones, though. And I'm a little behind because I didn't read them all from the last episode. Mm-hmm. And I'm probably not going to get through all of them today. But this one comes from Erica in the 484. And it says, I hope I got the right number, or else this is going to be an awkward text for a stranger. I think you guys should do a season on battlefields. I live near Gettysburg, and it seems like every building around here is haunted. Would love to know which stories are real and which are fake. Keep up the good work. So, well, it's something we'll certainly consider.
We got to get a Tesla.
That's right. Right. That's something I won't make any promises, but it is something that we'll consider anyway. So this one comes to us from Frank in the 770. Good morning. I'm an avid fan of the podcast and a proud Patreon supporter. I loved your book, Cabinet of Curiosities 4, about 20 keys from haunted hotel rooms. Wondered if you have any knowledge of hauntings at the Tutwiler Hotel in Birmingham, Alabama. I do not, unfortunately. I have an upcoming reservation there. Surprised to hear it referred to as the most haunted hotel in Alabama. I don't know much about Alabama, to be honest.
Let us know if anything happens.
Yeah, my wife and I previously had an unexpected encounter at the Admiral Hotel in Mobile, so I think I may have a knack for accidentally booking haunted hotels. I'll bet you do. Love the podcast, books. Keep doing what you're doing. Sincerely, Frank. I don't have anything about that particular one, but it's interesting. I'll see what I can find.
Yeah.
Let's see. This was the one about somebody had asked about haunted houses that from the season, which one would you live in? And somewhere on here, I have a couple of answers. I'll find them in a second here because everything is just a whole bunch of different long, things.
Yeah.
So, but this one comes to us from the 407. Hey guys, been a loyal listener since season 3. Recommend your show to friends all the time. When someone's bold enough to ask me about podcasts, I started re-listening to seasons 1 and 2, and I'm enjoying the more ghost-centric stories as we enter the high holy days of spooky season. Also, you made me ugly cry during the Donner Party episodes, but
we made way too many jokes. I guess it's laugh or cry.
Laugh or cry. All right. So this one is, let's see, Melissa in the 847, listening to your episode from August 27th and says, I know I'm always behind. It's somebody sending you good thoughts.
Thank you.
In the 847. And then here's an intro. I could save this for the movie episode, but it really doesn't fit the theme, but it's a good question. It comes for us from the 612. Have either of you ever heard of or seen the movie Lake Mungo? And if so, what did you think of it? I have seen it several times. We both
same
have.
Here.
It's a good movie. I really liked it. I thought they did. It was one of those things where it's sort of found footage. It's more like interviews and news stuff, but they do it right. And then there's some phone footage and stuff on there. Yeah, I think that one is really well done. That is one of my favorite of the, found footage genre kind of films. And ghost story, too.
That pops up on a lot of lists and stuff. But when people are asking me, hey, can you give me a horror movie that I probably haven't seen? That's one that I toss their way because I'm like, you probably haven't seen this and it's good.
Yeah, it really is. That is a very good one. So, okay, this one comes to us from the 612. This is a spoiler for later in the season, but I'll read part of it. So, Hey, Troy and Cody, just wanted to say how much I enjoy listening to your podcast. And I listen probably every day and have listened to most episodes multiple times. I'm currently listening to your newest episode. Wondering if you plan to do an episode about blank. This story is a creepy one. Also wanted to express my condolences to Cody. Anyway, keep up the good work.
Thank you.
The reason I left that blank is because that episode is coming up very soon.
This person will know.
Only this person knows.
That's awesome.
From the 612 knows that I'm doing or got an episode coming up on that.
So, I love it.
This one comes to us from the 678, and it says, hey, Troy, just watched an episode of Most Terrifying Places in America and saw you talking about the Lincoln Theater. If it hadn't been for your voice, I wouldn't have recognized you. Yeah, I wouldn't have either. Then thanks for the compliment about the storytelling, too. So,
yeah. Thank you.
Let's see. This is okay. So somebody did answer the question that they wanted to know if they could use Taliesin West. Could that count as a house they chose to live in? Not the one where the murders happened, but the other one in Arizona. And my answer was sure. Why not?
Yeah.
So why not?
That's kind of,
Why not? So,
safe.
This is a good one. It's a little bit long, but it's a good one. Comes from Kara in the 650. Says, "Hey Troy, Cody, listen to the most recent episode, which means I've officially listened to every episode, even Patreon, and usually do it while driving. I commute a lot for work. Discovered your podcast when you were starting season 4. I was thinking about the horror versus suspense part. But here's the other one. This is the part that was cool. Side note, I just moved to from Seattle to the Bay Area and had a work event in San Francisco at the Westin. So I stayed the night there to save a long commute. I didn't realize it at first, but the Westin St. Francis was the St. Francis where Fatty Arbuckle had his party. I'm pissed I didn't put it together sooner. I would have walked through more floors, but absolutely love the hotel since I felt like I was in that time period. I'm trying to check out all the historical places around here and would love an episode with some ideas on places to explore. I'm starting to go back and listen to the old seasons. Love you guys, Kara." So I'm saving part of that, though, because she did talk about the, you know, the suspense thing, and we are saving that. So and here's another one, too. So we're going to save that one as well. Let's see. This one's fun. This one comes to us from, Lenore in the 620. "Hey guys, I love the show, but I always wonder why you haven't covered one of the freakiest parts of Kansas history. I moved to this area from, we haven't done much of anything about Kansas yet, but I moved to this area from Chicago and recalled the story from hearing about it years before. I thought it happened in Missouri, but no, happened 7 miles from me in Cherryville, Kansas. The Bloody Benders deserve an episode. And I'm sure that at some point we will get to them. If you already did it, I must have missed it." We haven't. I've written about them in the past, but no, I have not. We have not done an episode.
You have my attention.
Yeah. Love the show. Thanks for all the hours of enjoyment. By the way, I actually own Vivian Vance's childhood home. You know, Ethel from I Love Lucy.
Yeah.
This is no haunting here, just a cool piece of history in a drafty old house.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, it's cool. Let's see. Horror and suspense. Told you we got a lot of those. We're gonna hold off on those. So we might make it through these today. This one comes from Ricky in the 614. Says, "Hopefully I got you guys some new subscribers. I wore my American Hauntings t-shirt to Kings Island in Ohio, and it sparked up a lot of conversations about the podcast in dead of winter. So awesome. Keep it up. See you in February." And that came from
Thank you. That's awesome.
Yeah. And let's see. This one is from Adam in the 419. I'm Adam from the 419, first line. Said, "Hey guys, hope the two of you are well. Thanks for everything you folks do for us. Your podcasts make my work day so much better. I work on a hog farm and help the sows have their babies." And while he listens to the podcast. So
That reminds me, what was that Canadian guy, the serial killer the hog farm? Anyway, I hope you're not disposing of any bodies, but yes. Thank you.
Well, there is a way to do it, I guess. This one comes from the 815. It's our last one today. "I love your podcast and the banter between you both. I'm going to make it to Alton one day for one of your dinners and to check out the museum. It looks spooky. I was shocked to hear the story of the killings at the Frank Lloyd Wright home in Wisconsin. And when shocked, I visited the house a few times and it always felt off and spooky, but never heard about the murders." Well, I guess they don't really publicize it there. It's such a beautiful area. It's hard to think of such horrible things happening there. So yeah.
That's how it goes. Sometimes the most gruesome things can happen in normal, beautiful places.
Yeah. So if you guys want to weigh in on the horror versus suspense debate that we're having, not even a debate, it's just what's the difference between the two? What makes it horror adjacent rather than just outright horror? I watched a horror adjacent movie last night that was actually pretty good, especially when it got to the end. That was a good one. But it is, there is something that is different. There's, how do you take that one step over the line? You know, how does it go from just being a thriller to being a horror thriller?
Yeah.
So, you know, it's a good question. So if you've got any ideas on that, send it in the hotline. Or if you just want to talk about anything else, you're welcome to do that too. You can text us at 217-791-7859. And we'll be back with some more messages next time, because we do have another episode next week. So that'll be October 22nd. So we'll have that one, and then that'll follow up with our Halloween episode the week after that. So
beautiful.
Yeah, Halloween is quickly approaching. So
it is.
That's all I got, man. So, all right. Yep. Oh, no, I guess I'm not done.
No,
I didn't thank anybody for listening. So that is all I got. So, yeah, thanks for listening, you guys. I felt like I had, but maybe not. But, you know, leave us a review, blah, blah, blah. Send us an email. Send us a text, 217-791-7859. Check us out on social media. You can find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, which we refuse to call X. Yep. Don't forget also that you can use the discount code podcast. I'm going to make sure I get that in there when shopping for books or tours or events or whatever at AmericanHauntings.net. You can also find the link there for Cody's shirt store, AmericanHauntingsClothing.com. And you can use the code there too. It's just podcast, just that word, capitalize it, don't capitalize it, doesn't matter. It's all the same. You always get 10% off everything you order. And now that is all I have.
So that's all he's got. Yeah. All right. Well, this episode of the American Hauntings podcast was written and performed by Troy Taylor. It was produced and edited by me, Cody Beck. To find out more about the show, check out our website, AmericanHauntingsPodcast.com, which features show notes, links that go along with each episode. I'm just skipping over that.
Yeah.
Thanks again for listening. We definitely wouldn't do it without you. So until next time, goodbye.
So long.
See you later.
See you later.
All right.
Yeah.
Short and sweet. Do we got done before?
Well, actually, that wasn't short and sweet.
Your Honor, we the jury find the defendant Sweet Tango Apples guilty on all counts of being the crispiest, sweetest, zestiest, most delicious tasting apple you can buy.
Order! Order in this courtroom! Bailiff, come back here. Where are you going?
I'm going with them. I want some Sweet Tango Apples too.
You love a great mystery, but not in the produce aisle. Be sure to reach for Sweet Tango, the most delicious tasting apple money can buy. Investigate where you can get yours at SweetTango.com.